Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Well, hello to you, Susan. I'm back from Georgia, back to Ames, and it's a beautiful day here. This is going to be a great show today. We have live guests with us for all three of our stories today. We'll have Dennis Keeney. He'll be with us to talk about his autobiography, The Keeney Place, which was just released last month. Dennis carried his story from a lively description of the life of a farm boy in the 1940s and 50s through university training in scientific agriculture that led him to become the first director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. Also in the studio to carry forward his reflections about the prospects for the road ahead is Cornelia Flora, Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Sociology, Agriculture, and Life Sciences.
This is the perfect time to announce the community reading of Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac on Saturday, March 7th. Irv Kloss will be here to tell us about that.
And we'll close out our hour with Marty Miller, giving us a preview of a musical event that will be here at the Pantorium on March 11th, a concert by the Harmelies. But now it's time to welcome Dennis and Cornelia. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Paul.
Well, it's really great to have you here with us.
But, you know, your story goes beyond being a hardworking farm boy, Dennis. As you made your life's work to make farming better, your path took some unexpected turns, I believe. I'm happy today that Cornelia is here to ask questions about just what happened along the way.
The book really starts with that farm boy experience, but it gave me an opportunity as I wrote the book to reflect back on what I learned on the farm. And in a way, I learned enough about life, so I was able to spend the rest of my career trying to learn why I learned it, what the science was behind it. And finally to realize that there were people that needed help within this farming community that weren't getting it with the current systems.
Well, tell me about things back on the farm. I have a lot in common with you because I grew up in the 50s on a farm south of Story City. I bet we have a lot of the same experiences, the same era.
Yes, I'm finding that with a lot of people who are reading the book, that the first chapter on the farm experiences is the one they relate to directly. And that's good. It's one that I think we need to make sure is available to our future generations. And, in fact, that's why I first wrote the book. I started with that first chapter just for something for my grandchildren and great-grandchildren to see. It grew beyond that over the years and is finally in this particular form. Because I did realize that the frustrations I had as a university professor, that I was able to apply very well to what I learned, but what I learned wasn't necessarily what I wanted to know.
To get back to that farm boy growing up, or farm kid growing up, when the number of farms decreased, and that's one of the things you discuss a little bit in your book and that most people know, the small farms were not viable. The farm kids left the farms. And, of course, one of the things you described was how enormously hard it was, the work that probably a lot of farm kids left just to get away from that work. On the other hand, when we first came here in the early 60s, there were still kids coming to the university from the farms. And in the lab, Fritz was in the chemistry lab. And those farm kids were great because they still had the attitude that they could fix things, that they could figure it out, they could make it work. The line used to be just to fix it with baling wire. So when the farms, when we talked about what we were losing from the farms, I kept thinking we're losing the people. We were not growing those people anymore. Have you ever thought about that?
Oh, very often, yes. When you drive by now, even the farm that I know as I grew up has changed largely because it's now in sort of an urban setting. Not really in the urban, but it's a very nice place. It has no resemblance to what I learned and what I grew up on. And as I drive down to the small town of Runnels that I grew up in, is now turned largely into a place where people with a lot of money pay their taxes and that sort of thing, but that's it. They don't connect to that land. Connecting to the land, as we know, is so important. And that's why, in the end, we ended up calling this the Keeney Place, because we wanted a place issue in the discussion. And we all have a place. Paul has his place. You have yours. Trinity has hers. Even the people, I suppose, that grew up in the tenement slums. have a place, but not anywhere near as much as we had. We were very fortunate in that way.
Yes, that's an era when you could raise a family with a 160-acre farm. And what I remember my own growing up was the tremendous work ethic that you had on the farm, because you did all this work from a very young age. I remember driving a tractor when I was 8 years old. And I remember also the fact that we just got up and went to work. So finally, when I was 16, I was hired by a farmer to bale hay. I was paid for what I've done for free for years, and I thought, retirement can't be far away. $1.65 an hour.
Yeah, I had those same experiences, and I think a lot of us did. You didn't think anything about it, getting up at 4 in the morning to help milk the cows, going through 3-foot snow drifts and bearable heat, but getting the cows in the morning was worth it.
But one of the things that I'd like to think about with this was how much, by what you had a work ethic, but you also had a knowledge ethic. You knew a lot. There was a lot of knowledge in everything, these wide range of things you did, from baling hay to fixing the tractor to milking the cows to making sure they were fed properly. And now we're seeing that agriculture is still knowledge intensive, but all that knowledge is now taken off the farm. And that incredible amount of knowledge that you gained through your hard work, that's the part that may be fragile.
I think that's what gives me a kind of a unique perspective here, because during my professional career, I saw that knowledge disappear and was part of helping it disappear because of the big system that we built around the university. I saw Extension kind of move back and let industry run its show and get into a different mode. It was not necessarily anybody's fault. It's just a terrible way that things seem to happen in capitalistic America and elsewhere. And in the end of the book, I try and make the point that there's going to have to be a comeback to this more fundamental way of thinking about the land. And that's what I hope the Leopold Center and others will do.
Cornelia, I'd like to have a little more of an introduction to you. They've been talking about their farm boy experiences. Did you grow up on a farm?
No, I grew up on a Navy base in the middle of the Mojave Desert. I did marry into a farm family, but I did grow up into a base that did research and development. And it was the kind of thing where the scientists would work on something, then you'd take it to the air. They were working on the Sidewinder missile, and the pilots would test it. Then you'd go right back that night. The scientists would work on making it a little bit better. So you had this incredible interaction between the scientists and the user that, again, I think we've had some very good parts of that in our land-grant universities as well. But no, I have no milking cows experience.
But how did you decide that you were interested in rural sociology?
Well, I worked in rural areas, and I found communities fascinating, and I thought that that's where I wanted to be. There was one rural sociology course at UC Berkeley. I took that course, and my professor had come from Cornell, and that's where he got his degree. So I said, okay, I'll go to Cornell. And they offered me a scholarship, and I went. And when I went at Berkeley to see my professor, tell him, this is wonderful news, I'm going to Cornell. And he says, you're leaving here for there? But it was a good decision.
That's actually two very big status symbol schools. That's quite a choice. But I think the main thing that we are focusing on here with regard to Dennis's book is that there is a progression in the book from the things that we all knew growing up to the changes that have been made and are being made and the things that are occurring to change agriculture and how it's done. And then, in a way, you're talking about a full circle back, aren't you, Dennis, that a need to return to some of these things that we always had before in agriculture.
That's correct, but I'm not talking about throwing away the technology. Yeah. You can't throw away the technology. It's very important to the way our world has been built now, and then the demands for the carbohydrates and proteins that we see, although we could do a much better job of that. I just am very concerned the way we treat the land. I'm a soil scientist, and a lot of soil scientists have the same concern as do a lot of conservationists everywhere. This is nothing really new, no new revelations. It's just we don't know how to do it.
What do you identify as one of the most threatening things that are happening to the soil, the way it's practiced today as agriculture?
It's probably still being mined. Most places it's being mined. The phosphorus and even the nitrogen is going down. We add it with artificial approaches, but that doesn't necessarily bring us back to the full system. And, in fact, when we add these artificial nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers, they escape the environment too quick. And so we see the pollution of the lakes and streams that we are having now. And one of the things I contend is that no matter what you do with the systems we have, they're going to pollute. If you're going to back off and save our water, you're going to have to back off and learn how to get more, if you will, grass on the soil, get more green, and figure out ways to make a living doing that, not necessarily growing subsidized corn.
What about the depth of the topsoil in Iowa?
It's decreased about a half as we have the calculations, and it's probably pretty close to right. It happens very slowly, very hard to measure. Whether it's still going down is a question. It has to be in some extent when you see what's going down the Mississippi River. And we think there's more carbon going out, more organic matter going out than's coming in general. So it has to be going down, but it's hard to measure from year to year. It's probably decades.
One of the first things that I ever learned about soil since I've been involved with KHOI was the very first interview that I went out with Paul, and we interviewed Kermit Miskell. And he talked about the effect of the heavy equipment going across the land. And you mentioned that in your book. Could you elaborate a little bit on what that means?
Yeah, that's a hard subject or way to talk to. The equipment we're using now, there's a lot less pressure on the soil than there was in the past, because instead of a small two-row tractor going every back and forth over the field, we have huge machines that only go a few times over the field, and because of pesticides, we've cut down on the time we use that. But compaction is a hard one to measure. We know still that we have infiltration problems when it rains heavily. You see that happening when we get the flash flooding. And I haven't really seen data that tells us whether it's getting worse or not, whether we're improving. We're probably improving to some extent over what it used to be.
What about cover crops and the use of plants and borders that lessen the runoff into streams? Is that something that's becoming, the average person believes that that's becoming a lot more common. Is that an illusion, or are a lot of farmers adopting this?
I think it's becoming more common. Percentage-wise, it's not anywhere near what it has to be if we want to make a real difference. You can just drive up by 35 in the spring, and you'll still see very much of that practice going on.
No, I've noticed that myself.
Yeah. We can claim we do a lot percentage-wise each year. Maybe we're doing a little more. But it's so far from the absolute, from the amount that's needed to control water quality and save the land that I don't have much hope.
What about crop rotation? I see corn in the same fields year after year.
Yeah, that's a fairly common quote-unquote rotation now, and that is a practice that is only supported by continuing use of pesticides and fertilizers, and it is not a good practice over the long run. Now, corn does, in some ways, is less abusive to the land than soybean, because corn adds a lot more carbon back to the land and tends to be less erosive than the soybean. So the corn-soybean rotation is actually probably the worst thing you can devise to really control soils. And there's ways around that. The Leopold Center is working on some what they call strip cropping. The strips are actually permanent rows and that sort of thing. There's a lot of good stuff going on, but it still is not adopted anywhere near enough.
About how it's being adopted. Well, the main reason that I invited Cornelia in today was because I had a conversation with her, and I asked her if she'd read the book, and she said, it's a very important book, and I would like you to help us to see what parts of it we can draw on.
Again, I think the whole book is really a good piece, and I think the fact that Dennis has taken us from the reality of farm life in the 40s to the science of how do we make life both easier for farmers, but most importantly, how do we make sure the land is still there and still healthy is extremely important. And I think the way he was able to do it through his leadership of professional associations, through his leadership of the Leopold Center, through his work with trying to partner with a wide variety of players was very important. And what I must say about Dennis is the first time I met him, we were both on the board of CAST, the Council for Agricultural Science and Technology, and we were both very concerned at that point about what was happening to the land and the people on the land. And then when he became director of the Leopold Center, I was not at Iowa State during this time. I was at Kansas State University and then Virginia Tech. But he brought in social scientists as well as a wide range of biophysical scientists to say, how do we address these problems? Because his background said, we know this is a whole, an entire thing, not just little parts. And so I think that his book, which starts with that holistic farm, the feelings as well as the soil structure, takes us to then to the work that he has done and his attempts to say, let's keep that vision.
I think that that's just a very good way to put that. You know, when I look back on my own background, I remember my father was so multifaceted. When you looked at a farmer in that era, you had to be an animal husbandman, a manager, someone knowledgeable of markets, a pretty good mechanic, and you had to have all kinds of skills that come into play in running a farm, because we had so many, almost all farmers I was aware of, were livestock and grain farming. Now we have more of a monoculture. And Dennis, when did it become such a soybean corn culture?
I think it really started to happen. Of course, markets were being built. It's one of those things that the government does when they see something is being produced in excess. They build another market, like the ethanol story. So it's hard to put it exactly. But it happened when pesticides came in.
I was thinking after World War II especially, there was a trend toward that. Yeah. Because I remember we had oats, alfalfa, corn, and beans, mm-hmm. and sometimes sorghum, just on our 160-acre farm. That was quite a bit of crop variety. And we chopped corn for silage. And there was an oats harvest in the middle of the summer, which I loved. All that golden grain in the middle of the summer before it got cold, my favorite harvest. And I just, we had such intimacy. I've stepped on every piece of that land, because I walk beans, okay? I've stepped on every piece of ground there. So that kind of intimacy, that's lost too, isn't it?
Basically lost, although we fight it in the younger generation. It's coming back. I have a granddaughter and her husband now who are doing grass farming in southwest Wisconsin. They know exactly what their land is, and a lot of other people do. And even as I wander through the state fair, and I always go through the 4-H exhibits and the animal exhibits, I see so many great young people out there. So it's not over.
No, I'm aware of that, too. I'm on the 4-H Foundation Board in Story County, and I am very impressed with 4-H clubs as they exist today. And I look back on my own experience, and it was a great opportunity to learn. We always raised beef cattle, and we named them, and I loved them. And then I knew that I had to send them away at the end of the county fair. And there's an intimacy there, too, and a lesson about life cycle. And thank God we did it, because paid for college, at least partially.
That's right. And I did the same, but it was dairy instead of beef, although I raised some beef.
My husband put himself through with selling eggs and chickens.
Yep.
Where was Jan's farm?
Quinter, Kansas, western Kansas. Very low rainfall, but wheat and sorghum,
cattle. Wheat and sorghum, yeah.
But not anymore, right? They now grow corn out there, don't they?
Some grow corn. Didn't look very good this year. The Ogallala Aquifer is going down very fast.
Well, this was something that really shocked me, and it happened. Well, it happened obviously after 1957 when I was married, because I remember driving out toward California. We went out to Berkeley right after our wedding in Junction City, Kansas, and we passed all these wheat fields with oil wells in the middle of them. And I thought, boy, that's the way to you grow your crop on the top, and you have an oil well. And then a few years later, when we were driving out and taking a trip similar to the one you described in your book with your family going out to the Badlands and the Black Hills and to Yellowstone, it was all wheat with these great big circles of irrigation. And I thought, corn. It was all corn instead of wheat. And I thought, well, we're growing plenty of corn in Iowa. Why are they growing corn down here in Kansas? Can anybody explain what happened? Has that got to do with the farm supports for corn or something?
Yeah, that's completely true. The farm supports have made it profitable, and we've worked hard on federal government's worked hard on marketing overseas, but that really hasn't brought a lot of extra push to cropping. What really has done it is the biofuel approach towards farming. I can't think, but laugh, you've got all these oil wells out there pumping oil that's turned into fertilizer so we can grow ethanol here to displace some of that oil.
There's logical problems there.
There's real logic. There has been logic. Not political problems, just logical problems.
But, you know, I remember my father and his brother and their concept of it was all wrapped up in farming. They went through the Garden of the Gods in Colorado, I believe it was, and they said, this is wasteland. They'd missed the beauty of the place. Mm-hmm. To them, it was not tillable, you know.
Yeah, that's another wonderful part of a rural experience is you appreciate the landscape. And then as I grew up in the soils, professionally in soils, I appreciate it even more. And my wife, Betty, often complains that I just spend most of my time looking out the window because I want to see that landscape.
Well, my dad and all his friends traveled at 40 miles an hour mm-hmm. because they had to look at the rows and, you know, compare the crops farm to farm. Mm-hmm. And that was why Mom always said, drive faster, John, drive faster. But, you know, the other thing about it is all the interdependent systems with the loss of population in rural areas have really changed too. There are several churches I'm aware of that have closed because they were based on the idea there might be four or five farm families on every section. And when you look at the businesses in town, same thing. It was built on the assumption that you'd have all these people there, plus all the school consolidations. Over my lifetime, I think I saw figures that there were 4,500 school districts in Iowa in 1951. Now there are 338. That says something about what's happening in the rural areas of Iowa.
And I'm like, is this a progression we're going to have no matter what? Was technology going to drive us this way?
On the other hand, we have the oppositional technologies.
Mm-hmm.
We have the ability to work from anywhere due to high-speed internet access. We have technologies that will allow people to be more self-sufficient in terms of, now this is not in Iowa, but in South America, we're working on having people support a family of six on 1 meter square garden. So we have ways of doing things that would allow for a more dispersed population. One of the issues, of course, is what are the services available? And those services include medical and schools in particular. And one of the issues we have, I think, is that we're saying, gee, we need fewer schools. We're continue to consolidate our schools. We continue to centralize our medical facilities. We're finding this even in Story County, that things we used to provide in Story County, now you have to go through a regional hub. So you're sort of taking away the ability of local areas to service themselves. It's all sort of in the name of efficiency, but efficiency in what?
Good point. You know, mm-hmm. if you drive into northwest Iowa and areas like that, there are very few towns that are of any size at all, and they're not fortunate to have population centers nearby. If you look at Spencer and all the surrounding area, that's a big chunk where there are very few services without driving for miles and miles and miles, and that has to impact things. But one thing I've noticed is, to some extent, a return of truck farming. You know, the idea that you can raise vegetables and look at all the wineries that have sprung up. There's a lot of small operations, farmers markets. Are these not a harbinger of better things or not?
I believe they are. There's obviously 95% of Iowa's tilled land is going to stay the way it is, more or less, maybe even more than that. I would guess that the beautiful parts of the small farming are not going to be enough to support a lot of the lifestyles that we'd like to have. You're going to have to sacrifice a lot if you're going to be that kind of a farmer.
And it's a lot of work.
A lot of work always is, yeah.
Now, Neil, one of the things that I think my questions that I would love to see you explore are the parts of the university that university experiences that that Dennis had, and how you see it. You're in it. I only see it from the edge.
Well, one of the things that was important is the Leopold Center was established because of a very tiny tax on nitrogen fertilizer per pound, not as a percentage of the cost. Now, the cost of nitrogen fertilizers increased enormously, but the sales of nitrogen fertilizer have gone up, but not that much. And so we see sort of this integrative place in the state of Iowa, because it's not just Iowa State, it's the whole state of Iowa that this center was set up to serve, basically having constant decreases in budget at the time when we have these very important questions related to sustainability. What do we do about our crops? What do we do about our soils? How do we make them all work together? And what about the people involved? So at that period of time was a revolutionary idea with what they thought would be a good source of funding, turns out to, sort of like the gas tax in Iowa, not followed the inflationary trends. So that's one issue. And how did you see that? Did you see that even over your tenure as director?
Even a non-economist can see that if you got the same amount of money and prices are going up, you're going to have less spendable income. Well, Leopold Center had that problem almost from the beginning. They were the legislation did stop us from putting a lot of people on the in the center, and that was good. It stopped us from having a big farm or something like that, so money could be used pretty effectively. But big, the big landscape type of research that needs to be done in this area takes money because there's people to be involved and of work. You can't just do it on the cheap. And that money is decreasing. And if you go out and try and get grant money, as you, as a scientist knows, you have to sell your soul to do that. And there's some of the souls just don't want to give up that much of their freedom to do that kind of research that somebody else wants.
Well, you know, I want to thank you both. You're listening to KHOI's Local Talk. That's 89.1 on your FM dial. Dennis Keeney and Cornelia Flora have been talking about Dennis's autobiography, The Keeney Place. Now, before we go on to preview a couple of events coming up here in Central Iowa in March, what better time than to play this song and lyrics you quoted at the beginning of the book, Dennis, Woody Guthrie's, "This land is your land, this land is my land."
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. The Keeney Place is about people and stories. That's what we've been talking about up to this point in the program. Now we turn to an event on the same theme, the annual reading of Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac. Irv Kloss is here with us to tell us about it. And Irv, would you read the little section from the Keeney Place about the Sand County Almanac or about Leopold and the land ethic?
Okay. Dennis wrote that, what a powerful name, the center's namesake, Aldo Leopold, a Burlington, Iowa native, remains the icon of modern conservation thinking, an individual blessed with gifted thought and a golden pen. Leopold was a dedicated taskmaster and someone who had no qualms swimming against the current. Leopold's A Sand County Almanac and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring have become the two most influential environmental books of the modern era. In the final essay of his almanac, titled A Land Ethic, Leopold shares this wisdom. One of the most quotable quotes, I think, from that book over and over. It's been printed in other books. He said, "A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. Conservation is a state of harmony between men and the land," unquote. So that's essentially the essence, I think, of a Sand County Almanac. The core of it is this, is the land ethic. But, you know, as it's pointed out in the film that we'll be showing on March 7th, Leopold said no one writes a land ethic. No one writes an ethic. It develops in the hearts of a community. So I think that that has to be understood. And today I see that there's still a great need for an ethic for the land. And I think that our industrial agriculture and the things that have come with it have strayed away from that. And so we need to somehow bring that back into the community thought.
And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted you to come today, right after the discussion of the Keeney Place, because it seems to me that as somebody who actually grew up in farm country and only went out to farms a couple of times in my life growing up, I've discovered agriculture through farmers, through the people I know who are doing it, not through the actual work on the farm. But what I have come to feel is that every person I meet who is doing farming and everything I learn about the land has enriched me. And it's this awareness that we need to spread. And I think that one way to do that is through this almost ritualistic annual reading of the Sand County Almanac, which is about 2 hours, incidentally. Is that right? It takes about 2 hours?
On March 7th, we will read sections of the Sand County Almanac. And then we're going to try something new this year. I discovered that long ago that Leopold started writing back in his early career in as a forester in the Southwest. And a book that was published now about 20 years ago selects a number of those articles that he wrote for the Journal of Forestry and for other journals at that time, and how he was, in some cases, he was dead on right. And in other cases, he was before his time. In fact, one of the things that Leopold was known for that he changed his attitude towards were predators.
Yes.
When he first went to the Southwest, he believed that killing all the wolves and all the mountain lions and anything that preyed on game animals like deer and elk, which he loved to hunt, by the way, was a good thing. And he went around, in fact, forming groups of people who would go out and kill these predators. And later in life, he discovered this was not the right thing. So in the Thinking Like a Mountain, for example, he talks about the green fire disappearing in the eyes of a wolf that had been shot. And that's, in fact, the name of the film is Green Fire that we'll be showing. And that film won an Emmy a few years ago, and I think if you haven't seen it, it's really worth the time.
And if you have seen it, it's worth seeing again.
Absolutely. I've seen it 17 times, and I never get tired.
Well, now, where is this going to be shown, since we're now in the...
It'll be in the Brown Auditorium at the Ames Public Library from 2 to 5 on Saturday afternoon, March 7th. And so we'll be reading, as I say, from a Sand County Almanac, but also some of these, a couple of these articles from the book called A Leopold's Southwest. And it's a fascinating book because the editors of it write a critique after each article telling where Leopold was right and where he was wrong, and showing the evolution of his thinking, which was culminated in the book, The Sand County Almanac. I'd like to say a little bit how this practice got started. In Wisconsin, which is where Leopold spent much of his later career at the University of Wisconsin, and he also bought a farm up north of Madison near Baraboo, and in the little town of Lodi, about 20 years now, they started reading the Sand County Almanac aloud. And it's kind of grown, and now there are over 30 towns in Wisconsin doing this on the first week of March every year, which has been declared in Wisconsin by the legislature to be Leopold Week. Well, now Iowa has declared the first week of March as the Leopold Week. And he was born in Burlington, Iowa, so it's only fitting that Iowa also celebrate his life, and this is the way we do it, and keep that idea of the land ethic alive.
And spread it. Spread
yes,
the consciousness.
Spread
in fact, this was one of the things I was thinking about when you came on, because we usually try not to promote events that are taking place in Ames, but I realized this could be an inspiration, because a lot of towns might be doing what Lodi, Wisconsin did.
Absolutely. Burlington has actually started reading Leopold during Leopold weekend. And Grinnell sent a contingent of people over a few years ago to Ames to participate in our readings, and they now have started one. I heard that Storm Lake has also started, but they do it in the fall. And so it doesn't matter that you do it the first week of March. It can be done any time. And I would urge any little town that is interested in this to get together and start reading. It's fun, and it's a community affair that everybody can participate in.
Oh, I think that sounds like a good idea, and I hope our listeners hear it and feel inspired. And I've asked Dennis and Cornelia to stay for this segment. Do you have anything you want to add to what Irv has said?
I just want to ask a question, because to me, when we hear land, it sounds that it's only the soil. And the land ethic, it seems to me, for Leopold, was the ecosystem.
Yes. In fact, he emphasized that in a number of places, that it included the animals, the plants, the air, and the soil. And so he was an ecologist before the word was popular. And it's amazing how much insight he had. In fact, he wrote in one of these essays on the Southwest, he wrote about the changes that had come about since settlement in the Southwest. He said about 1882, it may have been a little before that, but the change in the attitudes towards fire, they quit burning, and natural fires were a part of the ecosystem. And he was saying that it was damaging the land, and that we needed to open up the forest and have more fire in it. And, you know, they're still struggling with that. The Forest Service has had a long time policy of controlling fire. And I just heard in a seminar at Iowa State just a few weeks ago by a young woman who's doing research on this in the Front Range of Colorado. And she said that the Forest Service is actually opening up the forest by and they were trying to determine how big a opening should be built or should be cut. And then I said, well, what happens after you get it cut? Because that promotes grass at the start, but then it fills up with brush and becomes a fire hazard. And I said, you need fire to maintain that system. And she said, yes, that's a big worry because they can't do it because there's now 4.5 million people live in that area. So it's not always easy to manage land as it once was.
You know, we used to have oak savanna, particularly out in eastern Iowa, and now that's being all taken over by conifers that used to be burned, and oaks, of course, were fire resistant. So this is now a huge pest for farmers and ranchers out in that part of our state.
Thank you for mentioning that. In fact, we have a small, very small patch of oak savanna that was once oak savanna on Ada Hayden Park, and we're trying to help the city get that restored to a oak savanna. It'll be one of our heritage ecosystems out there.
Thank you very much. It sounds like we could probably keep this going for another hour, but we have another guest who's going to tell us about something very important for us here at KHOI and for some young women who contacted him last week. So, Marty Miller?
Yes. So, thank you, Susan. What a fascinating discussion you guys gave us all, and really enjoyed it. And, you know, there's a natural segue here. We listened a few minutes ago to Woody Guthrie, and so we heard, this land is your land, this land is my land. When Woody started his musical career, like so many artists and musicians of those time, they traveled the country and looked at it. We have, coming to our community, the Harmelays. These are two young women that are very talented, wonderful singers, and can play wonderful instruments. Great. They have a wonderful show to put on, and they have a lot of humor in their show, this sort of thing. Now, these are youngsters that are coming our way. They're only 23 years old. To me, that's very young. And here these two young women are traveling the country. They're not doing bars, and they're not doing big venues. They want to do house concerts, just like Woody did in the old days, going around here. And I learned about these two. I've been following them for a couple years. I'm a big YouTube follower. You know, I just love YouTube. And I found them on YouTube, and I learned they have a new CD coming out, which is called Pretty Pictures, Dirty. It's a wonderful CD. So these youngsters are coming to Ames, and I really appreciate KHOI, who will be hosting them right here at the radio station here on March 11th. It's Wednesday, March 11th, a couple weeks from now. And they will be presenting their concert here. They write most of all their own music, and the kind of music is folk music, just like Woody and Arlo are doing, and Americana-type music. And I think they're going to be most enjoyable to listen to. I'm thrilled that they're coming to Ames here. And they actually contacted me because I wrote a review on their CD, which was very positive. And I've been viewing all these reviews, and they're all positive. And they said, gorgeous harmonies, great instrumentals, and a very enjoyable show. We're going to have them here in Ames, Iowa, in a couple of weeks.
That's right. And on the morning of March 11th, they're going to be right here on Local Talk.
That's right. So we'll get to learn about them and their trip and what influenced them to become musicians. They met in college, actually. They went to Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, which is their hometown now. Actually, they're not from Nashville. Their names are Haley Grant and Kaylee Jasperson, and one is from the suburb of Chicago, and the other one's from Colorado. Met in college, and the chemistry worked. They were both music majors and delightful young ladies.
And on a road trip that includes Ames.
Yes, right.
Our road trips usually work the other way.
That's
We'd
right.
go out.
They're very anxious to come to Ames and looking forward to it, though, and we're anxious to have them. It should be a great concert.
We need a little preview of their music. So Hesitate, do you think that's the
Hesitate
one?
Hesitate is a good cut right from their new CD.
I paint my face every color. I do my body just the same. I try to blend with the mustard while I hide my thoughts in my pain. You can't hear what I'm thinking. You can't feel how I feel. Sometimes I get tired of being the mouse spinning.
The Harmelays singing Hesitate, one of the songs from their CD, Pretty Picture Dirty Brush. And Marty Miller has been with us to tell about the concert that they are going to bring to Ames on March 11th to the Pantorium. We're going to have a concert here in the Pantorium, and you'll hear more about it, I'm sure, over the next couple of weeks. And we will have them live on Local Talk on March 11th as a warm-up for their concert that evening.
Well, your Local Talk hosts today have been Paul Wearson and Susan Franson. Our guests have been Dennis Keeney, Cornelia Flora, Irv Kloss, and Marty Miller. The show was engineered today by Rebecca Brown.
Music you heard was This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land by Woody Guthrie from Folkways, the original version, and Hesitate by the Harmelays from the CD Pretty Picture Dirty Brush. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD Ballad of Kate Shelley.
You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org, where we are streaming live. You'll find recent shows on our homepage with links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate whatever fits into your budgets. We'd also like to hear your feedback, either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line. Or stop at the KHOI studios at 410 Douglas in Ames.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. Your participation as audience are what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
The house in a day or two or three or